Hi, and welcome to our 20 Lessons podcast. Today we're going to talk about the joyous part of the Jewish life cycle. So we're going to talk about birth of a child. We're going to talk about bar mitzvah. We're going to talk about weddings. And we'll get right to it. So the birth of a child, it's a time of great joy for all. But in Judaism, it's celebrated in very specific ways. If you take a look back in ancient times, in the times of the temple in Jerusalem, we were actually meant to bring specific Thanksgiving offerings in the temple for the birth of a boy or for the birth of a girl. And in fact, the Talmud also tells us that there was a custom in Israel, going back thousands of years, that a trees would be planted when a boy or a girl was born. It was actually a cedar tree for a boy, a cypress tree for a girl. The idea is that you know, this is a time of great joy, and now we will, God willing, be able to watch our children bloom and grow into these just wonderful people, just like the trees that start out with roots and just grow and bloom and become something magnificent. The first Shabbat that a baby boy is alive, a celebration is made. And that celebration is called a Shalom Zachar. Now, those Hebrew words, Shalom Zachar, can either be Shalom Zachar, which means welcome or hello to this male child, or it could be Shalom Zachor, which means hello or welcome and remember. And the question is what is the Shalom Zachar about? So one idea is that it's basically a beginning, the beginning of the Bris celebration. And if that was the case, then we'd refer to it as a Shalom Zachar, you know, welcome male child, because a Bris is only done for a male child. And it would make sense then that the Shalom Zachar, which is the beginning of the Bris celebration, is specifically for your male child that is born. However, many explain a Shalom Zachar as a Shalom Zachor, which means welcome and remember. And it's a reference to this idea that when a child is in their mother's womb, they learn the entire Torah. They're taught the entire Torah. There's this ancient tradition that they're taught the entire Torah from an angel. And then when they leave the womb, they forget it. But it almost prepares them to then relearn the material throughout their life. And the idea here would be that on this first Shabbat that they're in this world, Shabbat, we're told about Zachor et Yom HaShabbat. The Ten Commandments introduces Shabbat to us as a day of remembering Shabbat. So it's a day of remembering. It's a day to start recalling the Torah that we had forgotten as we left our mother's womb. And basically we begin a child's life, that first Shabbat, as a time of remembering, as re-exposing them to this atmosphere, this very celebratory atmosphere that is filled with words of Torah, full of words of Torah, to kind of start that process of remembering the Torah that they had forgotten, to really get them off on the right foot. According to this view, and according to this understanding of this celebration, this Friday night celebration, then some do actually extend it to a female child as well, and they would go with the language of Shalom Zachor, which is welcome, and Zachor, to remember. All right, then we have naming ceremonies. The male child has a bris, the female child has what we colloquially know it as a baby naming, but we'll talk more about each one of them. Let's start with the bris. And of course, when we start with the bris, we just have to share this old anecdote that a priest, a rabbi, and a minister, they walk into a bar. They hadn't seen each other for a while. They're good buddies. And they talk about their churches and their synagogue. And as the night goes on, they drink more, and it becomes more competitive. Each one starts to boast about how eloquent they are and how great they are and inspiring they are, that they could convert anyone to their religions. Eventually, the bartender's hearing this, and he's getting sick of it. He says, listen, human beings are easy to convert. You know what would be a real sign of glory? If you could convert a wild animal, if you can convert a bear, that's what your deal should be. You want to know who the best, most inspiring of you three is? See who can convert a bear. So they look nervously at each other, but they drank a lot and they have a lot of pride. And they say, okay, we're going to go try to convert a bear. And we'll meet up 1 week later to discuss how we each did. So 1 week later, they're back in the bar. The priest comes in, his arms in a sling, scratches and cuts all over his face, but he's beaming. And he says, it wasn't easy, but I did it. The bear tackled me at first, then I wrestled him for a while until we rolled into a stream. Then I dunked his head underwater, baptized him. He received his first communion, and the bishop is coming down in a week for his confirmation. I did it. Next, the minister comes in. He's wearing a pair of crutches, cuts all over his legs and his arms and everything. And he says, I pulled it off. And he explains that the bear kept attacking him, but he had his Bible and he just kept hitting the bear over his head with it. And eventually, the bear snatched the Bible out of his hand and he started to read it. And he's going to deliver the sermon this Sunday at church. Then the rabbi comes in. He comes in a wheelchair with a full body cast. He doesn't say anything. He goes up to the bar and he orders a drink. After nursing it for a bit, he finally says, in retrospect, starting with the bris was a bad idea. All right, now we can talk about a bris. The word bris is a shortened way of saying the two words of brit milah, which means the covenant of circumcision. The first major religious event in the life of a newborn boy is that brit milah, the covenant of circumcision. It's one of the most defining mitzvot in Judaism. It goes back to Abraham, the first Jew, some over 3,800 years ago. And the circumcision is the only mark that Jewish religious practice makes on the body, and it is a lifelong symbol of our faith, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that right now. As I said, the mitzvah of Brit Milah goes all the way back to Abraham, which means that it's also unique in that it was the only mitzvah given to the patriarchs, the only clearly written mitzvah given to the patriarchs. I mean, there is also, may you be fruitful and multiply, but this is like the one ritual mitzvah given to the patriarchs. And the fulfillment of this mitzvah by Abraham and his descendants, even before the Torah was given at Mount Sinai, is an indication of just how central the Brit Milah, or the Bris, is to the Jewish faith. It would not be an exaggeration to say that this concept of the Bris, both in the eyes of Jews and non-Jews, is seen as a defining element of Judaism. So where did this come from? So Abraham, we know that he was outstanding in his resolute faith in God. He came to a recognition of God, and his faith in God was unbelievable. And it was because of this unswerving commitment to this faith, to everything that God and this ethical monotheism that Abraham discovered stood for, that God chose him to become the founder of the Jewish people. And the mitzvah of Milah, which was given by God to Avram, the Bris, is intimately related to what it was that Abraham had committed to. It's related to the concept of faith, faith in God, and faith in the value system, God's, this divine value system. And therefore, every time, therefore, it's no surprise then that the Brit is our declaration of faith. It's the declaration of faith of the parents, and that is how they are going to raise their children, going back in a line that goes back thousands and thousands of years. So it also becomes a very important mark on our Jewish identity, and puts us in as the next link in the chain, going back to going back millennia. So that's the first interesting part about the Bris. And just so you know, the Talmud says that the commandment of the Bris, the mitzvah of the Bris, is equivalent to all of the other mitzvot of the Torah combined, and it brings a proof text from Exodus for this idea. As I said, more than any other mitzvah, the Brit Milah is intimately related to Jewish identity, as the symbol of the covenant between God and God's people, the physical manifestation of Jewish faith, but it does define Jewish identity. And perhaps it's for this reason that Jews throughout history have made incredible sacrifices for the sake of upholding the mitzvah of Milah, whether we were in concentration camps, whether we were behind the Iron Curtain, whether it was during the Spanish Inquisition, whenever it was, we continued doing the mitzvah of Milah completely ignoring any of the obstacles that stood in our way. And we know that the Talmud tells us that it was those mitzvahs that we sacrificed for throughout history that have been so enduring, that have been most enduring in the hearts and souls of the Jewish people across all denominations. And the Bris has upheld like that. So when we talk about the bris, we see some very interesting things, right? So we know that it's a mark of faith, and we know that it's a mark of Jewish identity. But it's interesting because if you explain what the bris was in the most simple way possible, you'd say it's removing something unwanted, right? Almost as if this human being was created incomplete, and you, at 8 days old, begin the job of completing yourself. You're right, removing the mila, removing the orla, removing the foreskin. This is this idea that God created us incomplete, and we begin the process of completing ourselves. And the mila is the expression, the bris is the expression of that. And I want to explain this a little bit more with the following story. This story is from the Midrash. It's probably one of the most enlightening stories when it comes to the idea of the bris. And it goes like this. It happens that the wicked Turnus Rufus, who is a Roman general, asked Rabbi Akiva, the great sage, whose deeds are more beautiful, God's or humankind's? Rabbi Akiva responded, the deeds of humankind. Turnus Rufus said to him, why do you perform circumcision? Rabbi Akiva answered, I knew this is what you were asking when you asked the question, and that's why I responded that the deeds of humankind are more beautiful than those of God. Rabbi Akiva brought him stalks of wheat and baked rolls and said, the stalks are the works of God. The baked rolls are the work of people. Aren't the rolls nicer than the stalks? Turnus Rufus said to him, if God desires circumcision, why doesn't the infant emerge from his mother's womb already circumcised? To which Rabbi Akiva told him, God gave the commandment to Israel for the sole purpose of purifying and improving them. Letzarefotam bahem, to as a way for human self-improvement to take place. In other words, the bris is the earliest reminder and the earliest lesson to us humankind that we are created incomplete. The world is created incomplete. And we are meant to partner with God in completing, perfecting, elevating our own lives and the world around us. So we take part in this early reminder in order that it stays with us literally as part of our body, as a physical reminder for the rest of our lives. Now, why is it done on the eighth day? So besides for the fact that the Torah says very clearly that it needs to be done on the eighth day, interestingly, from a medical perspective, the eighth day of an infant's life is the most preferable for a bris because of safety factors. Right, you have the elevated levels of vitamin K on the eighth day. You have the elevated levels of prothrombin, which are necessary to prevent hemorrhaging. So from a medical perspective, it makes sense the eighth day. But what's interesting is from a spiritual perspective, the eighth day makes a lot of sense. And I want to explain that to you in the words of the Maharal. The Maharal was Rabbi Yehuda Loh. He was the Maharal of Prague. He's famous for making the golem, that clay giant that would protect the Jewish community. But he was probably, more importantly, he was known for his incredible works on Jewish philosophy and Jewish spirituality. And he explains to us that the eighth day is above nature, meaning the creation of the world took 7 days, right? There were 7 days of creation of the world. That was the creation of nature. The eighth day then is a symbolic of the idea of transcending nature, going above nature. And really, that is what circumcision is all about. What the bris is all about is a call to action for this human being that you have the ability, as you perfect yourself and the world around you, to relate, to come into communion, to transcend nature and be in a relationship with God. So the eighth day, that's why we do the bris on the eighth day, because what it reminds us of is our ability, if we put in willing to put in the effort, to connect with God, that's the idea there. And interestingly then, the reason that the bris is on is on the reproductive organ, the sexual reproductive organ, also has a lot to do with this, right? When we think about Judaism does not stay away from the physical, but rather it uplifts the physical. And that's kind of what the bris is here to remind us about, that we have a job to do here. We have a job to elevate the physical world. And the idea here is that perhaps, the most potentially misused part of the human person is their sexuality. So we specifically put the sign on, you know, on the place of sexuality in order to make this very clear that even, you know, this area, it can be so misused, but as well, it can be the most magnificently used of who we are. As well, it's the reproductive organ, which is about Jewish continuity, Jewish identity. So there's a lot there. This is a survey discussion just to give you basic basic bullet points, but there obviously to talk about the bris, there's a lot there. Speaking of the bris, that's also when the Jewish name is given. For a Jewish girl, it's given at the baby naming, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But let's just talk about the idea of names for just a sec. Of course, there's that old story. A Yiddish-speaking newcomer to America takes his wife to the hospital. She's pregnant. She's, you know, she's due. And during that, she's in labor. And during the delivery, he finds out that his wife has twins, that they have twins, and he faints. And he doesn't come to for a few days. So his brother was brought in to help name the children. And when he kind of got up from his fainting, he heard that his brother, didn't he say, my brother named the kids? How can my brother name the kids? He's illiterate. He can't even speak English. Oy, I don't even want to know, but what did he name my baby girl? And the answer was, he named her Denise. Denise? Okay, that's not such a bad name. I kind of like it. What did he call the little boy? De-nephew. So let's talk about naming for a moment. So there's an ancient Jewish custom to name after a loved one. To name after a loved one or to name after someone whose life was particularly righteous. And the usual explanation for this practice is that the parents hope that in receiving the name of this family member, the child will emulate in life the virtues of this deceased namesake. I think there's a little bit more to it, though. To a certain extent, too, it's believed that the soul of the loved one lives on in the child who now bears his name. There's something about that as well. It's a little bit deeper, a little bit more spiritual. And indeed, learning about the people for whom they are named, it's an excellent way for children to identify with the history of their own Jewish families and by extension, with the history of the whole Jewish people. So I just wanted to point that out. There certainly is that custom in every section of the Jewish community. Now, what's a baby naming for a girl? So across time and across cultures, different traditions have emerged for acknowledging the birth of a Jewish baby girl. The Sephardic community has an age-old custom called the Zeved Habat, which is Hebrew for a gift of a daughter ceremony. And what happens is it usually does surround, you know, it usually does revolve around the Torah reading. You know, the father's called up to read for, to get an aliyah, and the grandfather's called, the family's called up to get an aliyah. But there's a lot more interaction. And what ends up happening is that after the aliyah, the congregation, that's like the congregation's cue to start singing traditional songs for welcoming girls. And these songs are ancient songs that have been sung by Sephardic Jewry for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Now, or over 1,000 years, right? Mainly these songs date back to the 14th and 15th century in Spain. They're known as pismonim or hymns. And the whole community, the whole congregation, the women and the men, they join in together singing these special songs as this girl receives her Jewish name. In the Ashkenazi community, the longest standing tradition is for the father to come to synagogue on the first Shabbat after his daughter's birth, or perhaps even not on Shabbat, the first Torah reading. The Torah is read Monday, Thursdays, and Shabbat morning and Shabbat afternoon. The father comes and receives an aliyah, right? He's called up to the Torah to make the say the blessings over the public Torah reading. Afterward, a prayer for healing is said for the new mother, and then the baby's name is publicly proclaimed. So again, it revolves around the Torah reading, which is quite a beautiful concept. And nowadays, there's been a lot of newer customs and traditions that have been added into the baby naming. But those are the basic structures of what the baby naming looks like today. Okay, so that's a good 20-minute overview on the birth, naming, bris of the newborn child, which then brings us to the Bar and Bat Mitzvah. The Bar and Bat Mitzvah is the next Jewish major Jewish life cycle event. Obviously, in between there are less major, so more minor life cycle events. There's the old, there's a custom called the upsharon, the chalaka, which is when a three-year-old boy receives his first haircut. In some communities, that it's at three when a young lady starts to light Shabbat candles, a little girl starts to light Shabbat candles. So there are different, there within different communities, there are different traditions that happen throughout as a child is growing up. But the Bar and Bat Mitzvah is the big one. So the Bar and Bat Mitzvah, let's just talk about what that means. Bar means son, Bat means daughter. You're becoming a son or a daughter of the mitzvot, meaning you've become obligated by Jewish law in the fulfillment of the 613 commandments in the Torah. They've now become your responsibility. It also refers, the Bar Bat Mitzvah, it also refers not just to the person that is reaching this age, but also it refers to the event. There's the Bar Bat Mitzvah ceremony or event. Let's talk about the event for just one moment. The Bar Bat Mitzvah celebration ceremony, it aims to acknowledge this important milestone in the coming of age of every Jew. And I think just something to keep in mind is that many societies and cultures have a coming of age ceremony. And what happens during these ceremonies says a lot about that particular society. So when planning for our children's Bar and Bat Mitzvahs, I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Right, what are the values that I want to instill in my child? What do I hold dear that I want to see continued into the next generation? What are those intangibles, the most valuable concepts and morals I want to make sure my children embrace? And then we would plan our ceremony and our celebration around those ideas. And through so doing, our celebration and our ceremony becomes extremely meaningful. But let's talk about what is the significance of this timing in a child's life. So as I said, right, the Bar Bat Mitzvah expresses a person's newfound adulthood in terms of mitzvot. 13 for a boy and 12 for a girl, that's when you become obligated in the performance of mitzvot. And as such, more responsible for your actions. Why 12 and 13? So it basically would correspond to when physical maturity happens. Physical maturity in general happens a little bit earlier for a girl than for a boy. And we see a deep connection that exists between physical and spiritual and emotional. Judaism looks at things very holistically, taking all of the different facets into account. So that's when spiritual adulthood comes in as well. Okay, so let's talk about this for a moment. So what we're celebrating when a child is bar or bat mitzvah is the obligation to keep the mitzvot. And the question that we'd wonder for a moment is, what's so wonderful about that, right? Think about in North America, right? You become held accountable under the law at age 18, at age 21, whatever it may be. But you don't celebrate becoming responsible. You don't celebrate your obligations that you now have. If anything, what you're celebrating is the release, the release from restrictions, right? So now you can drive a car. You're no longer restricted from driving a car. That's a celebration. Now you can drink alcohol. That's a celebration, right? Children, you know, kids go out and they celebrate that. But what we're celebrating in Judaism is exactly the opposite. We're celebrating the acquisition of legal responsibility. And how is that a reason? Why is that a reason to celebrate? So the very basic concept is that we see at 12 and 13 that now you have the ability to choose. You have the ability to choose between right and wrong. You perhaps beforehand you didn't. You know, as a child, that's not something that is within one's reach. You try to train your child to do something like that, but in Judaism, we really believe that real freedom of choice comes at this age, 12 and 13. And it's only when you have the ability to choose, it's only when you have the ability to make these types of decisions, to use your free choice, that then the choices you make become meaningful. And then when the choices you make become meaningful, that's how life becomes meaningful. So really what this point in time is about, it really begins the meaningful journey of life. Up until this point, you're far more like a robot. You're far more just respond spontaneously to externalities. Now that you begin having the ability to choose, now life can become meaningful. And what is there more to celebrate? What is more reason to celebrate than life becoming, than a life taking on a newfound meaning? In other words, this becomes the beginning of our spiritual journey. And that is a reason to rejoice, because now your life is going to mean something very, very deep, hopefully. If you want to speak a little bit more from a spiritual perspective, the way it works is we believe that that the entirety of the soul doesn't come in until 12 and 13. It may even come later, but definitely like the real entirety of the soul doesn't come in until 12 or 13. In other words, we say that when a child is born, the evil inclination comes into the child, and the soul's this lesser soul that a child receives upon birth, it's almost overshadowed by the physicality of the body. A yearning for any sort of spiritual fulfillment is muted by everything that this evil inclination represents. So in other words, it's the physical up from birth. It's the physical world that overwhelms that overwhelms the soul in a child. But it's once you get to 12 and 13, the soul begins to awaken, assert itself more overtly. It reaches its full level of activity. And now you really do have a balance where you can actually have free will. You actually can choose between wrong and right, spiritual, material, humility, and your ego, engaging truly in a full range of moral decisions. So there, that would be how to say it in a bit more of a spiritual manner. But what this means then is the Bar Mitzvah, there is no more meaningful date in the life cycle than when your meaningful living finally begins. Interestingly, just to point out that it's at a Bar Mitzvah that you become obligated in keeping the mitzvot, which means you're now held accountable for your own actions. You become accountable for your own actions, and in so doing, because of that, at the Bar Mitzvah, a father gets up and says a blessing. Blessed is he who has absolved me from the punishment of this child, because up until this point, it's the father that takes responsibility, the parents that take responsibility for their child. Now a child is on their own, and the parents no longer have to take responsibility. So that's the idea, the beginning of a spiritual journey, the idea of meaningful living. So it really is a big deal. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, he actually explains that it's at the Bar Mitzvah that you become a full-fledged Jew. Now, what does that mean? He explains that it's on this day that you become a complete part of the Jewish people, a part of the nation that began at Sinai and continues through to the end of all generations. Because now that you're choosing, now that you're making meaningful decisions, you now become an active member of the Jewish people. So really, this is the day when your identity and your citizenship as part of the Jewish people becomes full-fledged. Just one last thing to point out. So as I said, with this in mind, these types of ideas in mind should really help us influence and inspire what our bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah ceremonies and celebrations look like. The old saying is that we should make sure that it looks more mitzvah than bar, right? Bar, like place where they serve drinks. More mitzvah than bar. And if approached with this type of way of thinking, a bar mitzvah and a bat mitzvah have the power to be so meaningful and also offer the deepest sense of joy for both the parents and the children alike. So that's a little bit about the bar and bat mitzvah. Now, let's focus on the wedding. Let's focus on the wedding now. And just by the way, for the bar and bat mitzvah, the idea is that, that now that you are a full-fledged member of the community, it's all about, one of the paramount parts of being a member of the Jewish community is the Torah and our connection to the Torah. And therefore, to teach Torah publicly to the community is the highest, is absolutely the most meaningful thing somebody can do at their bar bat mitzvah. And that can take the form of sharing Torah that you've learned, You know, maybe it's in the form of a speech, maybe it's in the form of preparing before the bar or bat mitzvah, learning Torah, a special part of the Torah, and then sharing what you've learned with your community. That can look like reading the Torah from the Torah, learning how to read from the Torah. There's all different ways, but the reason that the Torah is gonna figure prominently is because there can be nothing that more signifies this meaningful entry into Jewish adulthood than by teaching, becoming someone that is contributing, teaching Torah, the highest part of the Jewish people, to their community. Okay, now let's talk about the wedding. So a traditional Jewish wedding is full of meaningful rituals that symbolize the beauty of the relationship between husband and wife, as well as their obligations to each other and to the Jewish people. It's customary that both the bride and groom go to the mikvah before their wedding, the ritual bath. But that's something we'll talk about in a later podcast when we talk about the idea of the mikvah, how that fits in, the idea of marriage, not the wedding ceremony, but marriage itself, the idea of Jewish sexuality, like all those things. That will all be a separate podcast. For now, we're just going to focus on what the wedding looks like and the surrounding events. So before the wedding, there's a special celebration called the Ofruf. So this is for Ashkenazic Jews. Ashkenazic Jews have before the wedding a celebration called the Ofruf. Sephardic Jews have a Shabbat Chatan, the Sabbath of the groom, after the wedding. But basically the idea is as follows. What is an Ofruf? An Ofruf means to be called up. What are you being called up to? Well, the groom is called up to the Torah before the wedding. So on the Shabbat, or any time before, or at really any time before the wedding that you read the Torah, so it could also be a Monday and a Thursday, there's an increased atmosphere of joy in honor of the groom. And the groom is called up to the Torah. And the idea is that this gets the marriage off on the right foot, right? The declaration of commitment to the Torah as the foundation of the marriage is a profound way for all of it to begin. Furthermore, the idea of celebrating together with the groom, giving them, you know, it could be a nerve-wracking time. It could be a time of you know, it's a scary moment. Your life is about to change. And surrounding the groom with love and warmth and excitement and cheer is a beautiful way for him to be able to enter into the wedding. The Kala, the bride, has what's called a Shabbat Kala, which means the Shabbat of the Kala. And so something very similar happens. Friends and family of the Kala, of the bride, come together with the bride on the Shabbat. And again, embrace her with warmth and cheer and joy as she is about to enter this next, this life-changing part of the Jewish life cycle. So you have the Ofruf for the man, for the Chatan. You have the Shabbat Kala for the bride. And that is a beautiful way to get you ready for the wedding day itself. Now, the wedding day itself is very significant in many ways. Number one, there's a custom for the bride and groom to fast, and not even just to fast, but to pray the special Yom Kippur afternoon service, complete with the confessional of Yom Kippur. So almost as if the day of the wedding itself is like a private Yom Kippur for the couple. And there's even a biblical source for this. Rashi, the great Jewish commentary, points out, bases it off of a verse in Bereshit in Genesis, that all the past transgressions of the bride and groom are forgiven on their wedding day. So it really does become like a Yom Kippur. It's a day of seriousness. It's a day of praying for others, where our prayers are particularly powerful. And the question is why is it that on the wedding day, are the transgressions of the bride and groom pardoned? How does this make sense? So again, I want to quote from the Maharal of Prague, who says that the idea is that up until this point, you know, you're no longer a continuation of your previous initial creation. Before marriage, he says, you're called a half person, but now you become a complete entity. In other words, we take a look, we look at the souls of the husband and wife, or the bride and groom, and we see them almost as half souls that come together to form a new entity at their wedding, one complete soul. So you become a new person. If you're a new person, then you have no transgressions of the past. And that's also perhaps why a bride and groom both wear white at their wedding. The bride wears a white wedding gown, and the groom wears what's called a kittel, which is the white almost robe that one wears on Yom Kippur. White is about being cleansed, it's about a shedding of past misdeeds, of past transgressions, and really it's a very powerful day for the bride and the groom. which gets you to the first step in the wedding process, which is called the Kabbalat Panim. Kabbalat Panim is the accepting of the faces, which really is just, you know, it's the way we begin our Jewish weddings. There is a custom for the bride and groom not to see each other for 1 week before the wedding to increase the anticipation and excitement of the event. So sometimes you'll find at weddings that the bride and the groom, they greet guests separately, and the bride's greeting area is called the Kabbalat Panim. The Jewish tradition likens the couple, this new couple, to a queen and a king. So the kala, the bride, will be seated on a throne to receive her guests, while the chatan is surrounded by his guests who sing and toast them. Sometimes the groom's area is referred to as a tish, which is a Yiddish word, which means table. And it's basically, it's this festive table where you're rejoicing with the groom, and the kala is doing that in her area. There's an old Ashkenazic tradition for the mother of the bride and the mother of the groom to stand together at this moment at the tish and break a plate. The reason they do this is to show the seriousness of this commitment. Just like a plate can never be fully repaired, so too a broken relationship can never be fully repaired. So it just reminds us what it is that we're getting ourselves into. It's at this point, it's at the tish. And sometimes the bride and groom will be sitting next to each other. The way I'm describing it is this traditional way of having the bride and groom separate until the actual chuppah, until the actual wedding ceremony. But at this point in time, the rabbi will look over the ketubah, the marriage contract, which I'm going to explain in a moment. And the groom formally commits to everything written in the ketubah, and then the two witnesses sign it. What is the ketubah, this marriage contract? It goes back, it's ordained by Mishneh, by the laws of the Mishnah, so around 170 of the Common Era. And some say it even goes back, it's even more biblical in obligation, so going back thousands of years. It's written in Aramaic, and it details the husband's obligations to his wife: food, clothing, dwelling, intimacy. And it also creates a lien on all of the groom's property to pay her, to pay the bride a sum of money and support should he divorce her or predecease her. As I said, the document is signed by two witnesses and has the standing of a legally binding agreement. It's very fascinating, and it's quite a beautiful idea that protecting the rights of a Jewish woman is so important that the marriage cannot be solemnized until the contract has been completed. It's pretty incredible that this dates so far back in time, when this idea of marital rights and a woman's rights didn't exist at all, and yet this was something that was a very important and significant element in the Jewish marriage. As I said, it's signed by two witnesses, legally binding agreement. The ketubah, the marriage contract, is the property of the bride, and she has to have access to it throughout their marriage. Oftentimes it's written with beautiful artwork, and some like to frame and display it in the home. Another interesting thing that is more often done nowadays at the Jewish marriage is the signing of a prenuptial agreement. There's a little point in Jewish law that says that in order for a husband and wife to become religiously divorced, a husband has to give his wife a get. Now, 99% of the time that goes smoothly, but 1%, less than 1% of the time, a man could theoretically use the get as a weapon and refuse to give his wife a get, a religious divorce, which would cause the woman to be an aguna, a chained woman. She cannot get married to somebody else, and she's caught in limbo. So it's a devastating, quirk. Quirk's not even the right word. It's a devastating legality when it comes to Jewish law. So what do we do? So nowadays, most rabbis will insist on what's called a halachic prenup. And what that does, it puts a monetary price on the obligations a man has, Jewishly has, to his wife. And it becomes a binding arbitration agreement. The courts will enforce this daily payment that the man owes to his wife religiously until the husband and wife are no longer married, through the giving of the religious divorce, the giving of what's called a get. The amount would be, the amount that's enforced is about $100,000 a year. So it puts the man in a place where if he wants to use his get as a weapon, it will cost him a lot of money. And you can even stipulate more money if the man that's getting married happens to be, if we're talking about the marriage of two wealthier people. And this prenuptial agreement has had a 100% success rate in the United States. Canada's a little different because legally they can't really enforce binding arbitration agreements that were done outside of the courts. But in the United States, this has a 100% success rate. And every single couple is encouraged to do this. And it doesn't take away from the joy of the wedding. It doesn't mean that one day, this marriage will lead to divorce. But rather what it does is it makes sure that every marriage that takes place can be done with absolute confidence. You never have to worry that that God forbid when a marriage dissolves or comes to an end that anyone will be victimized through it. Okay. After the ketubah is signed and the prenup is signed, then what happens is called the bedekin, which is the veiling of the kala, the veiling. Putting the veil on the face of the bride by the groom. The veil symbolizes the idea of modesty, but probably even more significantly conveys the lesson that however attractive and important physical appearances may be, it's the soul and character that are paramount. It's reminiscent of Rivka, the matriarch Rivka, Rebecca, covering her face before marrying Isaac. The Ashkenazi custom is that the chatan, accompanied by family and friends, proceeds to where the kala, the bride, is seated and places the veil over her face. And this also signals the groom's commitment to clothe and protect his wife. It's customary at this point in time for the parents and grandparents to bless the bride and the groom in the same way that God blessed Adam and Eve at their marriage. And then that brings us to the chuppah, the actual wedding ceremony. The wedding ceremony, the Jewish wedding ceremony, takes place underneath a chuppah, or a ritual canopy. It's a symbol of the home that the new couple will build together. It's open on all sides, just as the tent of Abraham and Sarah was open to all sides, to welcome people in unconditional embrace and hospitality. Some have the custom to have the chuppah outside under the stars, almost as a sign of the blessing given by God to the patriarch Abraham, that his children will be as the stars of the heaven, but it can also just as easily be done indoors. The Ashkenazic custom is that the chatan and kala, they wear no jewelry under the chuppah, right, in order to signify one reason, we'll talk about a second reason in a couple of minutes, or to signify their mutual commitment being based on who they are as people and not on any material possessions. The chatan walks first under the chuppah, and then he greets his soon-to-be wife under the chuppah. Generally, they're escorted to the chuppah by their respective set of parents. Underneath the chuppah, the Ashkenazic custom is that the kala, the bride, circles the groom 7 times before the ceremony begins. Just as the world was built in 7 days, the bride is figuratively building the walls, or basically symbolizing the wholeness and completeness that the husband, that this bride and groom would not be able to attain separately. Another idea is perhaps this is about creating walls. Although the chuppah is a public affair that does bring joy and celebration to as many people watching as possible, it's also an intimate and personal experience. So the circling of the bride by the groom may symbolically be setting up walls to almost create a chamber for just the couple during this incredibly personal time. The last idea that I want to share when it comes to walking around 7 times is that when the Jewish people entered the land of Israel from the desert after 40 years, it came time to conquer the first city, the city of Jericho. The Jewish people circled the walls of the city 7 times until the walls miraculously sank into the ground. Mirroring this, perhaps, the bride circles the groom 7 times to kind of take down any walls that may separate them as they embark on this eternal journey together. Okay, so that's a little bit now. And now, you know, oftentimes the rabbi will share, the one officiating at the marriage will share a few words about this marriage, and then they'll get to the ceremony. The first part of the ceremony are the blessings of Kiddushin, the blessings of betrothal. There are two cups of wine used at the wedding ceremony. The first one accompanies these betrothal blessings. After they're recited, the two betrothal blessings, the couple drinks from the cup. Traditionally, the mother of the bride gives the bride to drink. The mother of the groom gives the groom to drink. We'll see that that changes for the next cup. Wine is always used in Judaism. It brings a lot of significance to the moment. And then after those two betrothal blessings, the marriage becomes official when the groom gives an object of value to the bride. And this is traditionally done with a ring. A ring symbolically is the groom telling the bride, you are now the center of my life. Historically, it may have been that the woman, the bride, circles around the groom at first, making him the center of her world, and then he puts a ring on her finger, signifying she becoming the center of his world. The ring needs to be made of plain gold or some plain metal without blemishes or ornamentations in order to avoid any sort of confusion. To understand that it's this ring itself that she is accepting as the marriage gift or the marriage what is being given over in order to make this marriage official. And furthermore, we keep it simple to signify that this marriage will be one of simple beauty. So the chatan, the groom, takes the wedding ring in his hand, in clear view of two witnesses, declares to the bride, "Behold, you are betrothed to me with this ring, according to the law of Moses in Israel." He then places the ring on the finger of the bride's, and this is really the central moment of the wedding ceremony. And at this point, the couple is fully married. Now, before the next step of the wedding. We read the ketubah, and the reason we read the ketubah at this point is kind of to separate between two different parts of the wedding, right? If you go back to the 12th century, up until that point, a Jewish wedding was actually a two-step thing. The betrothal would happen as soon as the couple got engaged, and at that point, they were semi-married. They were formally committed to each other. They would transgress the prohibition of adultery if they were with anyone else. And in order to get out of this stage, you would require a get, a religious divorce. Then about a year later, they would have the second step of marriage, which is called nisuin, after which they would then be together as husband and wife. The rationale behind these two steps was to give the man some time to become financially stable in order for him to properly be able to commit to everything he commits to in the ketubah, in the marriage contract. By the 12th century, Jews were being persecuted. It was a very difficult time. There were many poor Jews, and it was just getting very expensive because you would almost have double weddings each time you do a wedding. So they ended up combining the two parts of the wedding ceremony, the kiddushin, the betrothal, and the nisuin, the actual marriage. So the ketubah acts as the divider between the two steps that used to be separate. Now we combine them, but we still have the ketubah being read in the middle to signify this is the first step of the Jewish marriage, this is the second. The second part is the seven blessings, the Sheva Brachot. And these are said over the second cup of wine. The themes of these blessings basically link the bride and the groom to faith in God as creator of the world, the bestower of joy and love, the redeemer of our people, and they really reflect the incredible benefits of marriage. These blessings are recited by the rabbi or people that the families want to honor. At the conclusion of these seven blessings, the bride and the groom, they drink some of the wine. This time the mother-in-law, this time the groom's mother gives to the bride to drink, and the bride's mother gives to the groom to drink, as if to say, now you are my child. Okay, then comes one of the most well-known parts of the Jewish marriage, the breaking of the glass. It's placed on the floor. The chatan shatters it with his foot. So on the one hand, this serves as an expression of sadness at the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and basically really helps identify the couple with the spiritual and national destiny of the Jewish people. The idea is that even at the moment of greatest rejoicing, we remember to set Jerusalem above our highest joy, as King David says. Some like to say that this is the last time the groom's going to put his foot down. Obviously, that's a joke. But an idea that I've heard that I think is really quite beautiful is that up until this point in their lives, the bride and groom have received so much from others. Different fragments of love and wisdom that help nurture and raise them. And now it's up to the bride and groom to take all those different fragments and put them together to create something uniquely their own. And that's the idea. And this marks the conclusion of the wedding ceremony. Shouts of mazel tov, an enthusiastic reception as the chatan and kala, the bride and groom, leave the chuppah together. In Ashkenazic tradition, the couple is escorted to a private yichud room where they're left alone for less than 10 minutes. These moments of seclusion signify their new status of living together as husband and wife. It's really the last part of nisuin, the last part of that second step of marriage that we spoke about. If the couple has been fasting, this is when they'll have something to eat. This is true for Ashkenazic customs. Sfardim, so the Sephardic community does not really do the yichud room. And then they continue on to the festive meal. It's actually a mitzvah for guests to bring joy to the chatan and kala on their wedding day. There's music and dancing as the guests celebrate with the new couple. After the meal, the grace after meals is said, and sheva brachot, the seven blessings, are repeated. And then during the week following the wedding, it's customary for friends and relatives to host festive meals in honor of the chatan and kala, the bride and the groom. This is called the week of sheva brachot, because at the conclusion of each of these meals, the seven blessings are again recited. And this could be a very special time to rejoice with the bride and groom after their wedding. We'll stop here. So that's the joyous part of our life cycle. And then our next podcast will be Judaism on Death and Mourning. We'll hope to learn together soon.